I remember when I was a kid or in that youth group, one of the advisors gave this definition of leadership of having something you want to do and getting it done. Vision and implementation. And Deepak, I have used that definition over and over again every time I teach leadership to my MBA students, to executives, because it's a definition that invites us to think about leadership not just as a position, the person in charge, which I talk about now as big L leadership, formal and person in charge. It's also a definition that thinks about leadership from anybody who can get something done, which I call little L leadership. And I found that provocative because what leadership offers us is making change in the world.
Solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential podcast.
Welcome to the next conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm excited to present this next conversation with Professor Wendy Smith, a professor at the University of Delaware and somebody who's researched tensions, paradoxes and dilemmas for many years. A couple of reasons why her work speaks to me. One is, as a leadership coach, I noticed that a lot of leadership is actually about navigating tensions, about balancing the short term and the long term, P&L and balance sheet, doing and being, and many other domains. Second, I've started to think about potential in a multidimensional sense and actually talk about it in my book, Play to Potential, that I published with Penguin a couple of years back, where I talk about how we handle these various domains, family, what we love, our energy, investing in ourselves, relationships, and so on. But the core idea to make this work is actually how do we embrace both and kind of thinking, something that Wendy talks about. It's not either or, but how do we solve these various things simultaneously while moving forward? So without further ado, let's dive in and learn from Wendy Smith on navigating multiple dimensions with both and thinking. Wendy, thank you so much for making the time and for coming on the Play to Potential podcast. A real honor to be talking to you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And as you know, we in this series, over the last 10 years, we've been focusing on three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. And it's wonderful to see that you've spent a large chunk of time focusing on both and kind of thinking. And we'll get to the details in a minute. But I'm curious about sort of the arc of curiosity for different people. And I've also come to realize that a lot of the research is often me search. You know, people are looking for answers for themselves and they end up researching a topic. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you ended up, studying this.
Deepak, I love that. In the introduction to our book, my co-author Marianne Lewis and I say, indeed, research for us was we search, me search for each of us. So absolutely. For me, the question of how to navigate competing demands emerged for me early on when I was thinking about my career. And I was grappling with real tensions. I was a college student at Yale University. Lots of people around me felt very pre-professional. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had come out of a significant amount of leadership as a kid. And I debated, do I do this leadership thing or do I study this leadership thing?
Say you came out of significant leadership in childhood, what do you mean by that?
So when I was a kid in high school, I was in a youth group. Deepak, I don't share this all the time, so you're jumping right in. And for no reason other than it just feels like it's part of my background and history. But I was the international president of that youth group and took my first year off of college to do that. So I spent a year at the age of 18 traveling around the world and teaching people about leadership, things that I didn't even know that I didn't know. So I have now gone into a profession trying to figure out what it was that I didn't know and how to help people do this thing called leadership that I thought I really understood at 19 or 18, but really didn't.
Sorry, you were talking about your arc of curiosity when I...
So I loved that. I mean, I really loved that. I loved what, for me, I loved what leadership offered for the potential for people to get stuff done. I remember when I was a kid or in that youth group, one of the advisors gave this definition of leadership of having something you want to do and getting it done. Vision and implementation. And Deepak, I have used that definition over and over again every time I teach leadership to my MBA students, to executives, because it's a definition that invites us to think about leadership not just as a position, the person in charge, which I talk about now as big L leadership, formal and person in charge. It's also a definition that thinks about leadership from anybody who can get something done, which I call little L leadership. And I found that provocative because what leadership offers us is making change in the world. And I loved that. And I wanted to know more, but studying leadership didn't feel like the direct impactful change that doing leadership felt like. And I felt like I was at a crossroads right at that moment. I will say, fast forward, I live a life now where I am privileged to hold together the knowing and doing, the thinking and implementing, the theory and practice. And I'm really grateful for that. But it took me years to figure out how to bring that together because when I was in my 20s and I was at a consulting firm and I was debating if I go back to get my PhD, and I went back to get my PhD with this lack of certainty about, do I actually want to be an academic, holed up in a way in the ivory tower, or do I want to be out there making a difference? It really felt like an either or decision. So that kind of tension was at the heart of what I was personally exploring. So thank you for starting there.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And in a way, I read the book that you've authored, both and thinking, very thought-provoking, because in a way, as we were discussing, as we were getting started, you know, I think about potential in a holistic sense. And a lot of it is actually about embracing tensions across various dimensions. If things were simple, if we were solving for one variable, it's easy, but we're solving for multiple variables at the same time. In a way, it requires a slightly different order of thinking. So when I saw your work, I was immediately drawn to it. And just getting into the book, Wendy, you know, it's useful to sort of clarify language. And you talk about tensions, dilemmas, and paradoxes, and you sort of tease out the nuances between these three. And I notice that very often I end up using these in an interchangeable way. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, what the distinction is between these three? And maybe if there's an example, just to bring it to life for each of these.
Yes, I love that. And by the way, I just want to put a pin in because I love that you're using language of holism and interdependence and multiple outcomes. And I hope we will come back to that because that is indeed so robust in what we are talking about. Systemic, ecological interdependence. Okay, so before we get there, before we get too far, the core, here's the big idea of this that we've been exploring. And again, when I say we, it's myself and my co-author, Marianne Lewis, and now a really big community of paradox scholars. There's sort of three big ideas. One is that life is filled with tensions. Tensions exist, meaning there are these opposing pressures, tug of wars, challenges, issues, problems. They exist. We like to think of them as a problem or a bug in the system. We will argue that it's not a bug in the system. It is the feature. That is the way systems are created, or our lives and our worlds and our experiences. And so we use that word tension as an overarching term to talk about all different types and experiences of tension. So in my career, as I was deciding my career, I felt this tension between thinking and doing, between practice and theory, and that sort of that tug of war feeling is the overarching term we use as tension. Uh-huh. Embedded in that are two different types of tension. The dilemma is the kind of trade-off in which you can make a decision, an either-or decision, and it is done and you are done. I had to make an either-or decision. Am I going to go into and get an MBA or am I going to get a PhD? Like, that's a dilemma. I have to make a decision and it's done.
Mutually exclusive choices, can we say?
Mutually exclusive choices. Although, Deepak, I'm going to come back and complicate that in just a minute. But to start with, mutually exclusive choices. I sometimes like to talk about the fact or the dilemma. I have three kids. My two older kids are twins. When they were younger, the dilemma of who gets to sit in the front seat of the car or whose movie we were going to watch that night or whose whatever. And we had to make a choice. There's one front seat of the car and somebody has to sit in it.
Right.
Or they don't sit in it, as it might be. But paradox, the word paradox is reflecting this idea of these opposing pressures, these tensions, these tug of wars that are not just opposing, they're also interdependent. They are reinforcing. They enable each other. The yin and the yang, the good and the bad that come together. The idea that in life, it's not just theory or practice. Theory informs practice. Practice defines what we need theory about, that in the ideal world, they go together. And that's what we mean by paradox, which is this idea that there are these opposing pressures that are not just oppositional, they are also interdependent. Okay, mm-hmm. So in my career decision, there is underlying that question of, do I get an MBA or a PhD? A question that the underlying paradox of theory and practice, of doing and thinking, of all of those underlying it. Okay, Deepak, this is where I'm going to get just a little wonky for half a second, because I know your listeners can come along with this.
Please take us along.
People will then often ask me, okay, so I have to figure out if the problem I am solving is either a dilemma where we have to make a choice. Do I get an MBA or a PhD? I just want to, you know, add to, like, for leaders out there, my dissertation was about innovation at IBM. And the choice that they had to make is, do I spend more of my resources on my existing product at IBM or more on innovating and doing new and novel things? So that's a choice of how I spend my resources. That's a dilemma where I have to make a choice. Underlying that choice is the paradoxical tension that every organization experiences between the old and the new, between an operational excellence and innovative experimentation that clash with each other. But if you're going to be an effective organization, you need to do both. Here's the complication. The complication is people will say, am I facing a dilemma or am I facing a paradox? Okay, if you know me well enough, and as we will go forward, as soon as you hear the word or, I'm going to challenge it and say, maybe it's an and. What we find, what we argue, is that these are not different problems. They're different faces, different lenses, different ways to look at a problem. Because what we argue is that underlying every dilemma is a paradoxical tension. So underlying the dilemma of who sits in the front seat of my kids is a question that they're constantly asking of, who do you love better, me or you? Well, it's not me or you, right? It's both of them. And underlying the dilemma of what I'm going to do with my career is this, again, underlying paradox of bringing together thought and practice, theory and engagement, lead, right? And underlying the dilemma that IBM felt about how do I spend my resources, and the either or question is this underlying question of how to hold both the today and the tomorrow, the existing and the experimental. And so the reason that becomes valuable or important is because instead of asking which of these is right, the question is, I can then choose to reframe the problems that I am experiencing from just seeing the dilemma to noticing and the underlying paradox. And that gives me a lot of agency in how I engage with the problems that I'm experiencing.
Fascinating. So in a way, it's almost like an iceberg. You know, dilemma sort of presents itself as the tip of the iceberg, but as you dig deeper, maybe there are paradoxes that can be unearthed, which sort of often are a little more stubborn, a little more long-term in nature. Is that maybe dilemma is a symptom and paradox is sort of a deeper condition which presents itself as dilemmas? Is that a better understanding?
I mean, I think it's kind of like, I'm sitting here with a cup of coffee that I just picked up in the morning, and I could either, you know, sort of decide at the top level how I want my coffee. Do I want it with milk or sugar? And at a deeper level, I can dig into understanding the chemical interactions of my coffee and what the most perfect thing is. Well, most of the time, I just want to put milk in my coffee and go and drink. And most of the time, we just have to make decisions. Who's going to sit in the front seat? How am I going to decide? But if we slow down and think deeper, and if my barista thinks deeper about the chemical interactions of my coffee, they will make me a better coffee that will be more exciting and more experimental and more creative, and I will enjoy more. That's the idea. The idea is that if we look at a flower and we see the flowers at the top of it, it's beautiful. But if we think about the DNA and the interactions at that level, we have a much more robust way of engaging with that piece. Now, I want to just be clear. The truth, like when it comes to my coffee, I don't have to think about that. Like a chemist has to think about that, or my barista maybe has to think about that. When it comes to our decisions, the invitation is that the more of us that can notice the paradoxes in our dilemmas and stop and pause and see them, the more creative we can all be, the more effective we can be, the more that we can be effective leaders, the more that we can deal with our problems better, it opens up new possibilities. And so then the invitation is how do we do that? Why is it that, you know, what we argue is that if we just look at problems as an either or dilemma, we argue it's limited at best and detrimental at worst. So why is it problematic? And how can we open up all this new possibility with both and? That's the provocative question.
Beautiful. And maybe just staying technical for a bit, Wendy. You also talk about the things that make paradoxes resilient. Yeah. Change, scarcity, and plurality, is it?
Yeah.
And you say these are the things that make paradoxes resilient. Can you sort of talk to us about these three terms and, you know, what is it about these things that make paradoxes resilient?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, here's some examples of paradoxes and how those three things came out of our research. And so here's some examples. We would say, look, here, every organization deals with a whole lot of paradoxes, but here are some that we see come up again and again. We talk about the paradox of innovation, the tension between today and tomorrow. The paradox of, we call it obligation, but sustainability, mission and market, social and financial, the bottom line and the broader purpose, purpose and profit. The paradox of globalization. Certainly, I imagine many of your leaders are experiencing that. How do we become globally integrated, unified, connected, and at the same time have very unique, distinct local adaptation? That's true for multinationals. That's true for as organizations grow, because we need distinct local attention. And then we talk about the paradox of coordination, or essentially what happens inside the organization. Are we more centralized or decentralized? Is it more headquarter-based, or are we going to be able to give people more autonomy? Are we more competitive or cooperative? Are we the kind of organization that's going to work with our competitors? How do we think about that? So these are just some of the paradoxes that organizations feel. What we find is that if paradoxes just lurk, they're sort of hiding behind the surface at all times, they become more salient to us. We're more aware of them under certain conditions. So one of those conditions is where there's more change. When the future becomes the present more quickly, we are experiencing that tension between today and tomorrow. And we are all feeling that right now. I mean, we're feeling all of these, but certainly imagine in the world of AI right now, we are feeling that tension between, do we do things in our traditional ways, business as usual, hold on to what's made us valuable, value humans, or do we move to new technologies, change the way we do things, adapt things? Because that technology is really creating this pressure of change on us right now that's forcing that question. And by the way, it is not either AI or humans. The brilliant organizations that are doing this well are figuring out how to bring those together, displace humans for AI, right? So change, plurality, what we mean by that is lots of different multiple voices, perspectives, approaches that we know that the more we can bring together teams of people, groups of organizations that bring together diverse perspectives, diverse approaches, the better we are. We know that's really hard to do, though. So how do we hold different approaches and perspectives? And that makes salient the tensions. And the third is the experience of scarcity. And I'm really clear to say the experience of scarcity? Because what we know from the research is that scarcity is partially how we approach resources. But the more we experience our resources, our money, our people, our food, our whatever it might be, as limited. Right now, we are all experiencing in our world today the scarcity of energy. The more limited we feel about the energy, meaning like petrol, meaning like, you know, the more we feel like that's limited, the more that we fight over who gets it. So if we feel like a piece of land is limited, there's wars over this. If we feel like in an organization that we have scarce financial resources, and everybody's going to be competing over who gets those financial resources. So those three conditions surface and bubble up the tensions, these paradoxical tensions, more explicitly.
Fascinating. If I may bring in my frame of curiosity, you know, in the book I published, I talk about the idea of leading a full life and playing the potential as a whole.
Yes.
And I suggest an approach called a flavorful life, right? F is sort of having a family orientation, sort of discerning the family context.
Yes.
L is having space for what we truly love. A is being true to our aspirations across the various identities we carry. BO is thinking about how we add value and how do we seek opportunity? How do we go on the talent market dating process? Just like product market fit, how do we find the talent market fit? U, of course, it's a British spelling. The American flavor spelling doesn't have the U, but for a minute, if we take the British spelling, the U is about investing in yourself. The U is physical health, mental health, spiritual health. And the R is relationships. You know, personal relationships, professional. And the idea is, how do you create a flavor that works for you? And the central idea is, in the middle of that wheel, if you imagine it, is how do you rediscover your flavor as life evolves, right? Because it's not static. Life context keeps changing. So to your point, there's change because life is never static. Life sort of comes with its own twists and turns as time evolves. There's scarcity in terms of time and energy and resources that each one has. And there's plurality because there are multiple dimensions, personal and professional and everything else. So in a way, I love the way you've framed the conditions of a paradox. And in a way, when I think about a flavorful life, you know, your work is, I'm sure, very pertinent in terms of what it takes to resolve it. But now just maybe moving to the how we grapple with this. As leaders, what's your advice for how we discern the various layers of paradox? Because even before we get to solutions, I think first level is, I would say, discernment. You know, what's your thinking on how people can actually unpack the various layers of what they see? Because we see the symptoms, but how do we unpack the paradoxes that might be behind the symptoms?
Yeah. I mean, Deepak, I would love to unpack a bit more of this flavor paradigm, because indeed you are inviting us to think about something that is multidimensional, systemic, interdependent. And yet one could see very easily how, while it's beautiful to have these things in alignment, oftentimes we're feeling those tensions. We're feeling those conflicts. In fact, when I do workshops whether it's for senior executives or whether if it's for frontline employees and new employees, and I ask people, okay, let's talk about a tension you're experiencing. The number, and these are like, I love the fact that companies bring me in to talk about tensions that they're working through in the company. And the number one tension they talk about, for example, is the tension between work and life. And so here I am doing a workshop for a company and they're telling me all the tensions are with the company. But we know that, right? We know that a huge tension that is quite universal is how we hold the commitment to our careers alongside the commitment to the things outside of our careers, whether it's our personal hobbies and ourselves and our well-being, our families, our, you know, what have you. And by the way, there's tension there because there's always this tension between what am I doing for myself and taking care of myself and what am I doing for the other? And here's how we know we have paradox, to your point, right? Is that, look, if we think about the self and the other, imagine what happens if we go too far to either one of those extremes. So if we go too far focusing on the self, we get to narcissism. We lose our connections to other people because people don't really want to be around us. If we go too far to the extreme of taking care of the other and we've lost the self, we burn out. We're no longer capable of taking care of the self. So in taking care of the other, we are no longer capable of taking care of the other. That's how we know we have paradox underlying our tensions, is that these things feel like they're in conflict. Am I going to go to the spa today and rejuvenate, or am I going to go to my kids, you know, soccer game? And so we know that there's conflict. There's conflict for our time. There's conflict for our energy. But we also know that if we just do one or the other and go to the extreme on either end, to your point, we live a life that is like more limited than otherwise. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I just was enamored by your systemic framework of flavor that I think is really valuable to surface about both how it is both interdependent, but also how it raises up these tensions. And it's both. That is exactly the heart of paradox.
Absolutely. And then one of the other examples I use, and you will relate to it since you sort of are in an academic setting, I say that solving for your career and being ambitious about your career is like getting a 100 in math or an A star in math or an A plus, whatever the grade might be. But, but the exam of life has many subjects, your health, your relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why I suggest the word aspiration rather than ambition, because ambition is like one thing at the expense of many things very often. So it's a longer chat. I'm sure just on this topic, we could spend an hour talking. But the point I wanted to make was, in a way, what it takes to resolve or to live a flavorful life, underlying that is actually, if I may use the term, paradox fitness, right? The one term I came across in my conversation with a lady called Jennifer Gavi Berger.
Yes.
She talks about complexity fitness, and she says there are different levels of complexity, and in a way, leaders need to discern various things, and there are different levels of complexity fitness. So similarly, how do you think about paradox fitness? You know, if I bring it to traits of leadership, you know, how do you, what does it take for people to be able to embrace and sort of really thrive in this sort of way of thinking and operating?
You know, I love that I love Jennifer Gavi Berger's work, and so glad that you have had a conversation with her. She's totally brilliant. I love the term fitness. And as you were saying, so I love that you've brought that in, and I want to think more about it because I have a gut reaction, which is a bit of my gut reaction around leadership, which is around this idea that sometimes we tend to think about traits. When we use the language of traits, sometimes we tend to think about traits as more static. Like, am I fit enough? Can I go to the gym? And, like the irony, by the way, about going to the gym is that people only go to the gym when they're fit enough to show up at the gym, right? And so I want to invite us into thinking about this from a learning perspective, a working out, a constantly growing learning dynamic, which I know is underlying this idea, but I want to make sure that we are not thinking about it in the way that, you know, the fitness world tends to be prohibitive of the people who aren't fit when they're coming
gym. It's much more accessible to many more people. It's not, I think that's a great clarification right off.
Yeah.
And
I want to, for me, it's a question of I think about it. Indeed, we have a paradox mindset inventory, and people can take it. It's on my website, which invites us to think about our proclivity to holding paradox. And it starts with, do you notice the tensions? Are you seeing them? So sometimes there are more tensions in the world and you have to see them. Sometimes there's tensions and we just sweep them under the rug and we don't see them. And are you open to holding these competing demands as a both and rather than an either or? So there are people that have more of a proclivity to that kind of open expansiveness than others, that we know in our research. And what I like to think about is, for all of us, what are the practices or the things that we can all do to start to engage more with this kind of both and thinking that opens up more creativity? What are like the very simple rules, the simple practices that invite us in? And I'm just going to start with one, if I can put one out there, because I think that engaging with paradox can be complex. And as a result, it can be easy to hide away from. It can be a little overwhelming. But so I think about it as, the metaphor I think about is meditating, because meditating can be complex. Like, you don't go from immediately into Zen master sort of nirvana moment, right? But when it comes to meditating, the first step in is noticing your breath, just coming back to your breath, pausing, coming back to your breath. Okay, we can all do that. We can do that whether we're sitting on a meditation cushion or whether we're in the middle of a difficult discussion with our senior leadership team. Just pause and notice your breath. Okay, this is my metaphor for we can all lean into holding paradox with one entry practice. And that practice is noticing the questions we ask, how we frame them, and changing the question. So if anybody is listening to this podcast, I'm going to give you some homework because I'm a professor, right?
Yes.
Which is the invitation is to notice how often questions get asked around us, framed as an either or, framed as a competing, we have to choose between them, hearing the or, hearing that it's one or the other, and then inviting in and reframing the question to shift it up into what else is possible. So if I go back to my career move, the or question was, okay, I have to make a choice. Am I going to get an MBA or am I going to get a PhD? Because that's going to lead me into two very different trajectories. And in a black and white world, you know, I was just going down a rabbit hole of which one is going to lead, you know, which one do I take? Okay, well, here's the more complex question. What is the MBA about? It's about, as I was saying earlier, doing leadership and being out there, being impactful. And what is the PhD? It's about studying and insight and understanding and depth. Okay, so if I reframe the question, what does it look like to have a life, to have a career, to work in a way that I can both be engaged deeply with insight and understanding and ideas and learning on an ongoing basis and growth? And at the same time, do work that feels impactful and makes a difference. And okay, that reframes the question into a totally different question and opens up all kinds of possibilities. And it's sort of whether I go the MBA route or the PhD route becomes less relevant to how I do either of those routes, to how I impact that question, how I do that. And I'll just say in the name of one of my advisors. So one of my advisors in my PhD at Harvard was Ellen Langer. I, you know, people should read her book, Mindfulness, from the 1980s. It's beautiful and brilliant. And one of the things that I loved about Ellen was that she used to, and that I've repeated multiple times, is that Ellen used to say, you know, it's not about making the right decision. It's about making the decision right. Because what she often, you know, what that pointed to is that sometimes we get so hung up on the either or of the decision that we don't think about the broader implications of how we implement that decision, which has much richer creative both and embedded in it. So I'll pause there. But
that sounds like great marriage advice.
Yeah, that too. You know, Deepak, I love that. I love telling the story that I once gave a talk to a bunch of engineers at Comcast. Very technical, very linear, very either or. And in the middle of the talk or at the end of the talk, one of the engineers came up to me and said, you know, Wendy, you just gave me all kinds of advice of how to work with my ex-wife. And I was like, well, there you go. That is at least that. that is a win.
Yeah, true, true. And I think just picking up on one of the themes there, even when we think about careers, I think a lot of us think about explore and exploit, right? Yeah. I think, do I go deeper in this and spend more time or do I try different things? You know, how do I think about the two? And you sort of suggest that let's be ambidextrous about this. Let's not, back to your point about MBA versus PhD, let's not frame it as an either or, but can we sort of engage with both? Is that a fair way to understand rather than treating them as binary, but sort of focus on the process of choosing and how we work with the choices over a period of time. And if I gave up, I mean, I'm just as you're talking a certain, if I look at my journey at some stage, I had a degree in management in India from the Indian Institute of Management. Yeah. Many years later, I wanted to pursue a global degree. I initially thought I'd do a PhD at London Business School. But, you know, the advice I got was, you know, if you're not sure about getting into academia, do a master's. So I did an MBA from London Business School. But today, when I look at the fact that I'm coaching leaders, et cetera, on one side, and then I have this podcast, in a way, I see the podcast as a backdoor entry into sort of studying or researching potential from my vantage point. So I think what I've come to realize is we don't have to get hung up about the title, but maybe as a verb in terms of our actions, we can make choices which can bring these various facets of life together in a creative way. There's an opportunity for creativity here is what I've at least understood.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love that, right? Deepak, your podcast is creating your own little PhD without having to worry about taking comps or comparative exams along the way. Or your dissertation. And, you know, I just want to go back to Explore Exploit. I really love that you brought that into the conversation. So as you may know, that's where I started on this journey. I mean, you asked me how where this bubbled up for me personally, but where I started on this journey intellectually was that very question of Explore Exploit. My PhD advisor was Mike Tushman. Mike Tushman and Charles O'Reilly are famous for having put out this theory of the ambidextrous organization, exactly what you're talking about. The invitation there was that if we're thinking about innovation in organizations, there's this tension as Jim March. So here's your PhD tray, but Jim March, 1991, put out a paper that said we have this tension that there's this tension between exploring for the future, doing a new thing. Exploiting, by the way, I know that real leaders out there don't always like the word exploiting, but essentially doing what we've currently done, success, going deeper, focusing on the core. And March said, look, adaptive organizations can't do one or another. They have to do both. Because most theory would say, look, it's so hard to innovate when you're doing really well in your core because the core holds you down and keeps you back, inertia in the core. And like Tushman and Charles O'Reilly said, you know what? You can't choose between one or the other. You have to constantly be exploring while simultaneously exploiting, because otherwise the future comes so quickly and you're not ready for it. So you've got to be having all these little experimentations. And the question that they were asking, and the question that I then asked as a PhD student, and the reason I was studying IBM was because I was working with Mike, was to ask the question, okay, but that's really hard to do for people. How do senior leaders hold this tension between the explore and the exploit, the old and the new, the both? That's the question that I asked in my dissertation. And by the way, to your point, it's not just how do leaders hold this strategically in their organizations, it's how do we hold this in our own leadership to constantly be doubling down on what we need to get done today so that we are effective implementers, and constantly changing and adapting and asking questions for tomorrow. You know, Deepak, I'm just going to add one thing. Yesterday, I was doing a workshop for senior executives of a major global bank. And the question came up in the workshop, well, how much time do we have to spend exploring, right? Like, you know, is this Google 20% time? Is this, like, tell me so that I can structure my work and my day around how much growing and adapting and changing. And I'm not sure that's the right question, because that's temporality shifts over time. Mm. The more important question is reframing the problem so that I'm not just allocating A or B, but I'm really committed to the fact that over time, I am going to be committed to holding both. I am both learning and reading, and which I think every leader needs to be doing is taking the time to read, which we don't have time to do, and exploring new ideas. And at the same time, I still have to be answering my emails. And the question is, how can I do both?
That's beautiful. Even as I think about my time allocation, you know, I could just focus on my clients and get 10 more clients and get busy. But then I sort of start petering out and, depreciating in terms of my relevance. I could just do podcasts then, but that may not put bread on the table. So how do you really think about the practice, the doing and the thinking, and sort of really exploring and the exploiting, and these are not either or, they're sort of happening concurrently. And one of the metaphors that I came across, which stayed with me just to finish that point, was this notion of ship of Theseus. You know, it's an old Greek paradox where, you know, if a ship is made of 1,000 bricks and you sort of replace it one brick at a time, after you've replaced all the bricks, is it the same ship or a different ship? So in a way, all of us, if we look at our identities, are sort of this sort of evolving ship in an evolving world. So it's fascinating how that plays out over time.
I love that. I'm glad you said that, Deepak. If you want to get even wonkier and more abstract for people on this call, so like if anyone needs to be super practical, just tune out for 1 second. But we know that's true about us as human beings. Our cells regenerate at a pace that those of us, you know, like every 7 years or whatever it is, that we are not the same cellular human being that we are born to be. So are we the same person? How's that for wonky?
Wow. Is it 7 years? I mean, what's the significance of 7 years?
So I'm not going to put a stake in the ground lest I'm wrong. Okay. So. Okay.
Got it. I think just moving on, Wendy, you say that we often fall into three different types of traps as we think about paradoxes. You call them rabbit holes, wrecking balls, and trench warfare. Can you talk a little bit about what are the kinds of mistakes we can end up making and how do we avoid them?
Yes. So we talk about these as the vicious cycles of the either or. So and the invitation here is to notice what we argue is that either or thinking, which is we're going to take a dilemma and we're going to focus on do I do A or B, we argue is limited at best. It's limited and it's really detrimental at worst. And we offer these three ways in which they are limited. So if anybody needs convincing that either or restricts us, sometimes we have to make either or decisions, but it's restrictive if we don't first engage the both and, here they are. The first is that we pick a side, we reinforce and intensify that side, and we get stuck in it. And we talk about that as a rabbit hole. So if we go back to the tension, for example, of the today and the tomorrow, explore, exploit, what we know is that organizations that do really, really well get stuck in their existing structures and processes and strategy along the way. We get stuck in that. And so we like to use the example of Lego. So if anybody knows Lego, the Danish company launched in the early 1900s as a family firm, eventually figured out the interlocking brick, this beautiful toy technology, into the 2000s, was so committed to this kind of toy and was so successful at it that they just resisted innovation. And so there's like stories about how it took them months and months and months to add the color green. They had five colors, took them months to decide they were going to add the sixth color green. Or the story that I really love is that the Star Wars folks came to them and said, hey, how about we co-brand? And they said, absolutely no way. So like really resistant. By the way, Deepak, if any of your leaders are hearing this, I just want to double down that the number one reason companies fail is because they are successful. The more success we have, the less reason we have to change. And therefore, when the world changes around us, we are stuck in the past. So if people want to feel a little anxious, that's what you should feel a little anxious for. We get stuck down this rabbit hole. We keep doing things the same way. Okay. Then when the world changes around us, anyway, yes, you get the point. When the world changes around us, we then swing into the opposite direction. We overcorrect. We call that, we use the metaphor of the wrecking ball, because you can just imagine that we like swing and throw out the good with the bad. Mm-hmm. And here again, the example of Lego. So many firms die when they get stuck in their existing ways and can't change. Lego saw that they were going down this rabbit hole, brought in a new CEO, decided that they can't just get stuck in the past. They have to innovate. And so they innovated at the extreme. It was like every kind of innovation possible. And so it was at this time that Lego started to not just turn the color green, but every color possible. They didn't just co-brand with Star Wars, but all these co-branding. It was this time when they weren't just in the toy industry. They started to get into the theme park industry, so Legoland. And it was this that almost led them to bankruptcy, because while their revenue skyrocketed, their costs went even higher. And they had no restraint on their innovation. So they swung from being so restrictive and focused on the existing world to so focused on innovation without restraint, without limitations, without simple rules, as Kathy Eisenhardt talks about, that they were almost bankrupt. Okay, so we see that. And by the way, they ended up coming back. Lego is a good story. They came back bringing in more restriction, more limitations, more restraint, so that they had simple rules to enable innovation amid their existing world. Deepak, I just want to say the third, and you said there were three reasons. The third is what I think of as the most pernicious and the most detrimental of either or. And this is when we pick a side. We believe in a debate, we believe that if we are right, the other side therefore must be wrong. And we get into conflict without really engaging in understanding. We call this trench warfare. That's the metaphor we use, because you could imagine that in war, you dig a trench and surround yourself with others that agree with you. Confirmation bias. We hang out at the water cooler with people that we agree with, talking about how we agree. We in the world, we listen to the news that agrees with us because we like hearing things that support our point of view. And then we shoot out at the other side, the nameless, faceless theys, without really understanding their point of view, without really listening, without really valuing or respecting. And so in a company, that could look like the R&D people and the finance people in constant conflict. In our world, it looks like the massive amounts of polarization between the us and the them, without really understanding, because of our commitment to it has to be either or, it has to be right or wrong, there's one truth.
And plus with the algorithms, plus with the algorithms of these large companies who've increased the friction, or yes, who've sort of made it much harder for us to access different perspectives. So it's much more convenient and yes, much less friction in sort of surrounding ourselves physically and digitally with people like us. So I guess it's gotten even harder because of technology.
Yeah, Deepak, I just want to say that technology is preying on our sort of inherent bias, which is that it's more comfortable for us to be around birds of a feather. We are more comfortable to be around people. So that is just magnifying. I mean, it is so hard. I talk to families that sit down and have differences of political perspectives within their family, and they will not talk about it because it is so emotionally hard to have that conversation. We don't have what we need in the world are the skills to be able to hold and listen and engage when people have these differences. It's hard. I don't want to make it easy, but wow, that technology is only magnifying and amplifying our gut reaction to that problem.
An adjacent idea to this piece is how we think about our identities. A lot of how we think and what we do is often governed by our identity. And very often we can construct a cage around ourselves that could limit what we could become. And a lot of it is possibly evolutionary. Jennifer Garvey Berger speaks about how we often become caged by our own identity. She says that we often fall victim to the notion of arrival fallacy, where we tend to believe that most of the key changes in life are behind us.
Most of us spend most of our lives believing that our major changes are behind us. And I wonder whether there's a kind of a psychological health. I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm just musing here, right? Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything that actually explains the why of it. But I have wondered whether it takes so long for us to develop into the time of our life, this sort of self-transforming time of our life when we welcome change and move towards it, as opposed to initially resisting it or finding it destabilizing. And so I wonder whether our brains have evolved to sort of trick us into believing it's all going to be okay from here so you can relax, as opposed to having us on constant alert our whole lives. So there's a kind of a, you've arrived, to take a breath, is kind of what our body and our brains are telling us, when really there's no such thing as arrival, right? The world is going to keep getting more complex. Our lives are going to keep changing. The demands of our lives are going to keep changing. And therefore, we're going to need to grow better and better able to meet those demands.
I find myself at one such crossroads. I recently completed 10 years of my coaching practice, and I'm at the threshold of crossing 50. In that context, like I do with my clients, I sent out a survey requesting feedback to some of my friends, some of my colleagues, some of my mentors, and so on how I should think about my journey ahead. One of the themes that has emerged is whether I'm being too fixed about how I see my coaching practice. I've always told myself that I enjoy one-on-one work and feel that's where I have flying miles. But with the book coming out and having put out an approach to think about potential where I urge people to consider living a flavorful life, Many people have indicated that I should probably be a little more open about experimenting with some of these pathways and not be wedded to my past way of doing things, almost like how Wendy describes Lego. I guess this conversation is a useful provocation for me to revisit some of the assumptions that might be holding me back. In that context, if you have any feedback for me as a follower of my work, do drop in an email to deepak@playtopotential.com. That's deepak@playtopotential.com. Thank you. And one of the skills you talk about in terms of navigating paradoxes is sort of this developing a bifocal lens, right? In terms of how do you really look at the and. Can you sort of unpack that? What does it take to develop a bifocal lens to look at the various, you know, ands in the various layers involved?
Yeah, Deepak, I'm curious what it looks like for you, how you've done it.
It's a great question. I think it's just, one is I just feel seeing the paradox, right? I just feel very often, you know, in Indian mythology, you know, there's something called the Bhagavad Gita, which is sort of a treasure trove of wisdom. And there's a god, Krishna, who's supposed to have spoken to a warrior called Arjun who seeks the wisdom. And one of the people I spoke to said that actually that's a conversation that should have happened between Krishna and somebody else, but that somebody else didn't even see the paradox. Mm-hmm. So I just feel, I think level one for me, to your point, you spoke about breath. I just feel improved awareness to be able to see maybe things in higher definition. Because very often I've noticed that a lot of us are sort of reasonably self-correcting and self-adjusting if we see the problem. So I think I feel the journey I'm on, and it's work in progress, like it's for everybody else. I think it's just improving the sort of awareness. Earlier, I used to be a habits junkie. I've come to appreciate, you know, in back to B school, our professors used to say, to solve any business case, we used to have a lot of cases from Harvard Business School, and they would say, to solve a case, you need conceptual clarity and contextual familiarity. And I would say the first 10, 15 years of my life, I focused on conceptual clarity, getting the formulas right, getting the paradigms right, getting the photos, five forces right, and so on. But I think I've come to appreciate the context. How do you read the context? How do you read the various perspectives around the context and see the picture as is? The next is, I feel, some sort of regulation, right? I think just sort of, again, responding and not reacting. How do you sort of put a regulator on the stove? You know, you don't want to be a flame that burns without any restriction. So how do you really bring a regulator on the stove, which adjusts how you respond? I would say those are the two broad, vectors around which I'm trying to be intentional, Wendy, over the years.
Gosh, there's so much in what you just said. I want to lift up just a couple of pieces, which are so valuable. The first is what I heard you say is that, you know, how do you just pause, noticing that our reactiveness is often, we're often triggered emotionally. Mm. And so instead of getting defensive, how do you sort of pause and hold that and think of a more thoughtful response, right? So we talk about finding comfort in the discomfort. It's uncomfortable to be in conflict. It's uncomfortable to hold this uncertainty. So how do you pause? And the Viktor Frankl, noticing that between stimulus and response, the pause is where everything happens. And then you also said, like, how do you step back and hold a broader picture so that you can see a bigger picture of the context? Deepak, I want to just say that's one of the brilliance of what coaching is about, is to help us when we have this kind of reactiveness to help us pause and think more strategically and hold the bigger picture so that we can see this broader and context.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's work in progress, but I've come to realize that sometimes, you know, just earlier I used to be much more binary about habits. For example, I used to say I want to train for half marathons, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It made sense in a certain context, but then as the kids start growing older and their schedules changed, it didn't make sense. So I had to sort of find a different way of being fit rather than being obsessed about clocking a certain time in a half marathon. So I think some of it is work in progress.
You know, Deepak, if I can toss another question to you, I know when we first got on, I was saying to you, I am so intrigued. I was sort of relaying that I've been doing this work on paradox now for about 20, 25 years. And I have this colleague who is from India who once said to me, Wendy, we in India, we just live paradox. And I'm wondering if it's a Hindu tradition, if it's from the Bhagavad Gita, if it's from, like, where does this come from? Or what's your theorizing on that? Or do you experience that?
I wish I had a clean answer. I just feel maybe there's something to be said about Hinduism, right? I think unlike many other religious practices where there's one God and often there's a certain set of, if I may say, rules, Hinduism is sort of, there's plurality built in. There are many gods. Many of them have their, you know, superpowers, and many of them have their shadows and dark spots. So in a way, it sort of teaches us to be plural in that sense. Second is, I think also, as we think about life, I think there's plurality in the way we think about family. I think Indian tradition or the Asian tradition, if I may say, I feel is also much less about the individual, about me, but it's about us. You know, there's a term called Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, which is about the world as a family. Now, the question is, how do you draw the radius around you? Is it just you, or is it your immediate family? Is it the community you live in, or is it the city, or is it the world? So I think, again, all of us are on the journey, and not everybody, that's not to say everybody in this country is an evolved human being. But I think there's a little bit of that wisdom tradition, I feel. And a lot of us, I feel, are inspired by different pieces of it and possibly embrace some of that.
Well, I love, first of all, that holding these tensions is about being more evolved. Because I do think, I mean, I think the world is demanding it of us now.
I think so.
And requiring us. And I also love going back to wisdom traditions. Deepak, you know, people, when I first started studying paradox in organizations, in social life, in leadership, you know, people told me not to study this, not to go there, because that's not what leaders wanted. That's not what leaders could hold. And, you know, I'll tell you this way. So a couple of years ago, the bottom line is that I think that we're tapping into deep insight from various wisdom traditions that are thousands of years old. Not something new, but, you know, Hinduism, but we also see these tensions in Buddhism and Confucianism. We see it in Judeo-Christian religions in different ways. My colleagues in Australia talk about how it's this sort of interdependence, ecosystem interdependence. Holism is inherent in, like, you know, tens of thousands of years of indigenous wisdom. And, you know, so a couple of years ago, Marianne and I won this beautiful award from an organization called Thinkers 50 called the Breakthrough Idea Award.
Congratulations.
I'm super honored for it. And what I said to them, which might not be the most gracious way of accepting the award, but truly it was, you know, I don't know that this is breakthrough, or at least it's not new of an idea. Paradox is as old as our universe. It's just that it has kind of gone underground, at least in Western thinking. And we have seen over the last couple of centuries how in different domains, this notion of interdependent opposites has come up in other disciplines. So like physics has moved, showing how our material world in the most wonky of ways is like quantum physics is all about something being there and not there, a wave and a particle, boom. Right. And so like 150 years ago, quantum physics moved from this linear way of understanding physics to a much more interdependent, you know, there's a great book, The Tao of Physics, Friedhof Kapper, right?
Or if we go with, yeah, big fan.
Beautiful, right? Beautiful. In the 1970s that he wrote. And then, you know, if we look at like how psychoanalysts think about the individual and the self, we've moved from like the naming the person as one or the other into like very Jungian, certainly Adler, Viktor Frankl, all of these sort of, you know, psychoanalysts out of Europe that talk about the self in a way that is like much more in the Hindu tradition, plural. It's both the id and the ego coming together, the self and the shadow self. So all these other traditions have talked about the ways in which our material world is paradoxical, our self, our individual self is paradoxical. But we haven't talked enough about is how our social world is paradoxical, how our organizations have these inherent interdependent opposites, how our leadership, how our relationships and our groups and our teams, And if there's anything that I think that I am on a journey for, that I have a soapbox around, is inviting us to realize how the social world is inherently paradoxical. And if that's the case, how we lead better in it, how we show up better in it, in our groups and in our teams and in our relationships and in our leadership, and how we can lead better through it.
This distinction between habits and awareness was brought to my attention by Devdutt Patnaik, one of my guests at the podcast, who explains it eloquently.
See, this concept of habits is a Western idea. It comes Indian, habit is a bad word in Indian philosophy. It's a bad word. Therefore, you're continuously, another word for habit is conditioned. I'm conditioned to do it. Conditioning. That's a Pavlovian response, right? A dog has a habit of salivating whenever the bell rings. And the West has made it a virtue. Action without thought is habit. Repetitive action without thought is habit. And if you look at many of the cultures in the West, they're like domesticated animals. At a particular time, they'll get up and run. At a particular time, they'll get up. So it's this kind of they are on a treadmill all the time. And this is seen as virtue. You know, driving in the car with a coffee in your hand. Nobody sees in America that this is tragedy. It's a tragedy. You can't enjoy your coffee. You can't enjoy your drive. You have glamorized slavery. You have glamorized slavery. And nobody sees it because you're all the Gurujis in their white coats with their chin, the fist on the chin photographs. You know, those photographs that you see. Are telling you, therefore it must be right. Nobody's questioning, what is the habit? And habit has been somehow projected as a good thing. Indian thought is all about awareness. It's all about awareness. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you not doing what you're not doing? And once you're aware, then you realize what is of value to you and what is not of value to you. So you are not in a habit. Then breaking habits becomes difficult. And then breaking habit becomes, there are good habits, there are bad habits. Habits are good and bad depending on context. You know, so you will find people behaving. That's why I always find, you know, when expats come to India, they have a tough time because the habit is suddenly in this new context, they don't know. Because, oh my God, there is no place to run. There is no place to, oh my God, they don't have this thing. Because the habit, right? They become the animal. They have become like an animal. And habit really goes to the lower part of your brain, not the upper part of your brain. And your habit is about avoiding life. You do habits like, it's an addiction.
It's like autopilot.
It's an autopilot. Yeah. No, and it's addictive. Like I have a habit of writing, but it's addiction. If I don't write, I get withdrawal symptoms, which means I've trained my body to be in pain when I don't do it and to get pleasure when I do it. And I'm not aware of it. I'm just doing it mechanically. So we are awareness culture. Awareness, 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 not habit culture.
This is not to say that we don't need habits. It is that we need to have habits and be aware at the same time. And that requires a bifocal lens that we all need to develop. And this is where we can learn a thing or two from the Japanese conductors in a train station.
The story, and I actually saw this when I went to Tokyo. If you walk around Tokyo and go to a train station, what you'll see is this interesting pattern where when the train pulls into the station, the conductor will point at like a signal and say the signal is green, or they'll point at the speedometer and say speedometer is 30 kilometers an hour. Outside on the platform, other employees are doing similar things. They're pointing up and down the platform and they'll say platform is clear. The cleaning staff, even as they walk onto the train in between sessions to clean it off, take the trash out and so on, they'll point at each car and, you know, say car is clean or trash is clear, things like that. And the purpose of this is that for anybody who does the same kind of job over and over again, like a train conductor pulling into the station, it becomes kind of automatic that, you know, it becomes habitual. And so it's very easy to overlook your mistakes. And so by pointing and calling, by literally physically pointing and saying out loud what you're doing, you're raising the level of awareness of the action. And you, people don't use the phrase pointing and calling, but you can see them do this kind of thing all the time in daily life. So for example, I have a friend who she'll leave the garage door up accidentally sometimes. And so now every time she pulls out of her garage, she points at the door and says, garage door is down. Or when you're getting ready to go on a trip or leave your house for a few days, you might double check everything and say, I have my keys, I have my glasses, I have my wallet. And you're like touching them in your pockets while you're doing that. And so those are all examples of pointing and calling to try to double check, to raise the awareness, to be aware, more aware of what we're doing. And if you want, you can actually use that same strategy when you're trying to build or break habits. So for example, if you want to stop snacking, when you reach into the cupboard to get out a cookie or go to the pantry to get out a snack, you could say, I'm about to eat this cookie and I don't want to because I'm trying to stop snacking. And just the act of saying that out loud before you do it might be enough to prevent you from it. It sounds silly. It sounds a little like over the top to do it. It would be a very useful strategy early on so that you become more aware of your behavior.
That was James Clear, author of Atomic Habits. The other dimension in which bifocal lens comes in is the way we think about P&L and balance sheet, both tangible and intangible, at work and in life. If we go hard on achieving results for today, we might deplete our reserves and our ability to get things done over the long term. Back to what Wendy says, it's not either or, but developing a bifocal lens that can help us see multiple layers of the paradox and hopefully be thoughtful in the way we reconcile them rather than taking a binary approach to such situations. Lovely, lovely. I'm mindful of time, Wendy. We have maybe 10 odd minutes. You talk about mules and tightropes as an approach to dealing with paradoxes. I was curious about these visual metaphors. Can you talk to us about what you mean by these two terms?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that in because I think that's an important idea for people to be able to hold. So if you ask, there again, I think holding paradox, holding both and can be complex. As we said earlier, step one is noticing the either or, realizing that it's a problem and changing the question, reframing the question. Step two is this question about, okay, well, then what? And so mules and tightrope walking talk a little bit about what are we trying to accomplish here? So I want to go back to my IBM study because this is where I first realized this was in my dissertation. Because when I went to go study these teams at IBM, what I thought was that the teams and the leaders that could hold these tensions between the old and the new best, we're going to come up with these win-wins, these creative integrations, these more expansive ways of engaging with, you know, with the old and the new. And that's what we call a mule, because the mule is the oldest biological hybrid. It is, you know, smarter than a donkey, stronger than a horse. You bring them together, you've got the mule. You've got this biological hybrid that we as humans have been breeding for 3,000 years. And so how do you come up with like the win-win, the thing that's better than both, and both are going to be accommodated in that? And that's what I thought IBM was going to do, was that they were going to come up with all these strategic decisions where they could bring the existing technology or the existing customers or the existing sales team into the new and the new technology, and everything would work out so beautifully.
Hmm.
And Deepak, that happened sometimes, but it happened very rarely, because what happened more of the time was that the IBM leaders actually had to make choices, either or choices between how am I going to spend my financial resources or how am I going to allocate my engineers? Am I going to put more of them onto updates for the existing customers to make them happy and develop that relationship? Or am I going to keep them on or put them on, you know, this experimental, what am I going to do for the new thing? It wasn't that there were always these win-wins. But here's the important part. In making those choices, the IBM teams that did well were the ones that could hold over time in the long run, both the existing and the new, and then make these sort of small tweaking changes where sometimes the choice advanced the existing world and sometimes it advanced the new, and they were constantly tweaking. And that's what we call being consistently inconsistent or tightrope walking. And we call it tightrope walking because the metaphor is that the tightrope walker is on the tightrope. They're going forward. They're not just oscillating and stuck. Sometimes we could just get in this rut of like both and, you know, well, I can't make a decision. No, they're making
sort of neither nor, right? The opposite of either.
Yeah, it's not the neither nor. It's also not, by the way, the and where you just keep adding and you fall off because everything is
interesting.
But what they're doing is they're they're never balanced, the win-win. They are always constantly making these tweaks, sometimes a little to the left, sometimes a little to the right in order to go forward. Here's the important point. They are not overemphasizing one side that they fall off. So the IBM teams that overemphasized the existing world couldn't innovate. They were just stuck. And the teams that overemphasized the innovation were losing out on all of the resources or revenues from their existing world. But the ones that could make these very delicate tweaks, holding both over time, seeing the bigger picture to your point, framing it in a broader context, those were the ones that were doing well.
Which is beautiful, because if I go back to the flavorful life, one of the things I tell people is at any point in time, maybe there's a family piece that takes predominance. Maybe there's a career piece. Maybe there's a health piece. But the idea is over time, you need to balance the wheel. You need to sort of be on the wheel. But it doesn't mean, it goes back to that quote, maybe Sheryl Sandberg said it, you can have it all, but not at the same time, right? So how do you really think about just sort of the dynamic optimization and be mindful of these paradoxes, of these sort of tightrope? And actually, when I thought about the textbook visual for the cover, I thought of a tightrope, but my publisher said that's too anxiety-inducing for the audience.
Well, I love that. First of all, I love that. Two things. First of all, we talk about it's not balance, it's balancing, to your point about it's dynamic. And indeed, people said to us, well, it's the same thing riding a bike, you know? But we purposely use the metaphor of tightrope walking because it is anxiety producing. It's not easy. We don't want to minimize this to like everybody can ride a bike and once you learn. No, it's hard. And it's not easy. You know, some people talk about holding spinning plates in the air and sometimes they come down and crash. We don't want to just sort of make it seem so simple.
Actually, the cover that I settled on eventually was juggling balls.
There you go.
Which is, wonderful. Wendy, we could keep going, but I'm mindful of time. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. What does the phrase playing to potential mean to you?
Gosh, Deepak, why? Tell me why you titled it that way.
I think I've been I must say, even my journey with the word potential has evolved over time. When I was a executive search consultant, it was much more about, you know, you can look at a candidate from a skills lens or a competency lens or a potential lens, which is sort of, in a way, what does the runway this person have? How much more can this person grow? So in a way, I was curious about how do we think about potential? But I think that's how I labeled it, saying, how do I think about, and also I believe back to what Warren Buffett says, you know, he says, some of us have the ovarian lottery. And I think the opportunity distribution might be skewed, but at least my belief is the potential distribution is uniform. Everybody has potential. It's just that different people have different resources and different constraints. So I was just curious about, you know, the unlocking of potential across different levels, irrespective of the ovarian lottery, if I may frame it that way. But I think over time, I've come to realize, in a way, this is subsequent to naming the podcast Play to Potential. I've come to realize that potential actually is a multidimensional pursuit. And in a way, I'm sure as I grow, my language or my relationship with the word potential will evolve as I sort of uncover various facets. But in a way, it started with this whole, if I believe that opportunity distribution is skewed, but potential is uniform, how can I study the unlocking of that and present that thinking and make it available for people to play to their potential?
Deepak, I love that. You know, I you're one of the first places I am talking about this, started working on the next book in which the question is, how do we be more expansive, hold out for more potential, engage more broadly in a world that is challenging and demanding and needs that potential, needs us to be more creative, needs us to be, and yet those challenges psychologically, sociologically, kind of keep us more narrow, hold us, those forces kind of make us want to hide underneath a rock sometimes because it's so uncertain and tough and anxiety producing. And so how do we hold for that possibility, expansiveness, and potential that we all have? And that is a place of agency. That is a question of what can we do to shift from these forces that kind of pull us into being more limited and narrow into being more expansive and hold that potential. So I love that.
Beautiful. On that note, Wendy, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and insights. Really, really pleasure connecting with you and exploring your
Pleasure.
Thank you. I hope you found the conversation meaningful. If you want to be in touch with our work, follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or most of the podcast platforms. You might specifically like the Connecting the Dots series, where I distill insights from 100 plus guests and take one theme and look at what different perspectives people can have on the same theme. For example, there's one on internal self-awareness, external self-awareness, listening, parenting, identity, injecting life into work, and so on and so forth. Please also visit playtopotential.com, where we slice each conversation into 10 odd pieces and then rearrange those pieces by themes. So there's a curated playlist section in the website playtopotential.com, where you have different themes like listening, you have habits, you have awareness, you have resilience, where there are multiple perspectives on one topic, which might be interesting to you. You also have links to the book Play to Potential and a journal Crafting a Full Life, where I talk about how we can manage these various domains and sort of manage the pulls and pressures of midlife in a way using the both and thinking that Wendy talks about in this podcast. Thank you once again for listening and for your time and attention. Look forward to you tuning into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.